Today marks the 40th anniversary of the Aboriginal Multimedia Society of Alberta, with media properties including CFWE and CJWE, Alberta's Best Country, 89.3 The Raven, Cousin Radio, Radio Bingo, and Windspeaker.com. Founder and CEO of AMSA, Bert Crowfoot, is with us for the next hour, sharing stories from the early days of AMSA to what it has become.
My parents were Cecil and Frances Crowfoot. She was originally an Osoup from Key Reserve in northern Saskatchewan. So I'm half Blackfoot, half Soto. I was raised on the reserve to the age of 12, grade 7, and I went to day school at Olson till grade 2, and grade 3 we were bused out to Carsland, about 50 kilometers west of Siksika, and went to grades 3 to 7 there. Grade 8, I went to Pannebaker Junior High in Calgary. I was placed on the Mormon placement program, and I lived with a non-Indigenous family for the school year. Grade 9, I moved up to Edmonton and lived with the Rosses for 4 years, grades 9 to 12. A great time growing up. I was, I think, one of two Indigenous people at McNally High School. After high school, I went to Brigham University for 3.5 years. I got married. And in 1977, I decided to take a year off and work, as, you know, most young university students, they are in debt. So I wanted to work and get back on track and go back to school later. I was originally in pre-med and switched to physical education and recreation because I was having way too much fun at school. I came up here and I was a silversmith over the summer and looking for work. And a friend of mine who was the editor of the Native People newspaper from Alberta Native Communication Society had asked me if I wanted to cover a basketball tournament in southern Alberta, because I was involved in phys ed recreation at BYU. I said, sure, I knew sports, so I could write. And so I freelanced and covered that basketball tournament for him. I must have done a good job because he asked me to come back the next weekend and cover a hockey tournament down at Picani. So I did that, and then I got offered a full-time job as a sports writer for the Native People newspaper, or Alberta Native Communication Society, ANCS.
In 1983, you began publishing Windspeaker. Tell us the journey to publishing Windspeaker at the time.
Like I said, I got hired as a sports reporter. I was also thrown into the darkroom because I had 1 week of photography in high school in industrial arts. So I was shown the basics, and I taught myself a lot of the darkroom techniques. I also taught myself photography. I had a lot of friends in mainstream media that I had developed friendships with, and they were always willing to help and share and give tips and, you know, ways to make my photography better. So that's how I got my start in photography as well. I was there for till 1981, and I worked my way up from sports writer to sports editor to assistant editor, and in the end, they had incurred a deficit of 100,000 plus, and we started laying off staff, and we used to have a staff of 11, and in the end there was three of us, three and one half-time person that put out the Native People newspapers a weekly. And in 1981 we hired a salesperson. That salesperson helped turn things around. We got out of the deficit that we were in, and a new board came in. The new board and I had, developed some differences, and I basically told them that I knew how to run the newspaper. I was told to give me a budget, and so give me a budget, and if I blow it, then fire me. I guess they didn't like how I spoke to them, and for the first time in my life, I got fired. So the friend of mine that hired me, he got fired too. His name is David Anderson, and we had met for coffee, and the sales guy we hired came along with us, and he said, I don't care what you guys are doing, but I like you guys, so whatever you're planning, I'm in. And so we started a newspaper in my basement called The Nation's Ensign. It was a monthly. It was like the Edmonton Sun that was around at that time, color front page, so we went color. He sold a lot of advertising, and we put out our first publication and showed it off. We brought it up to the annual meeting that ANCS was having up in High Prairie, and a lot of people said, oh, you'll never put out another one. Well, 6 years later, we were still putting it out, and I guess the... So from there, I kind of parted ways with my partner because we had a difference of opinion on how to operate the newspaper, and I left. I put out a powwow magazine called Powwow Trail 1981, and I sold all the advertising. I wrote all the stories. It was a photo magazine, so I did all of that. And when I was finished, my partner came back to me and asked me to come back because I knew how to make money. So I went back, and things didn't work out, so we split up again. And in 1982, I was hired back to ANCS to be the publisher. So I was there for a month, and then they lost their funding due to mismanagement. So that it was a kind of a tough winter for staff because ANCS was in receivership, so that wasn't they weren't laid off; they were still technically employed, and they couldn't get benefits, EI or anything like that. So over the course of that winter, we went hunting. We fed a lot of people, and I put together a. I was thinking about things, and I talked with a lawyer by the name of Rudy Gellert, who was the lawyer for ANCS at that time, a great guy. And we sat in his office and came up with a set of bylaws, and we incorporated the society, Aboriginal Multimedia Society, in the fall of 1982. The federal government and the provincial government liked how I ran things, and they had said that they would accept my proposal to set up a new organization, but they wanted to pick a board of directors that, like I had picked a board of directors, but they had offered to pick a different set of directors. And when I looked at who they had chosen, I was really impressed because they were really strong and well-known individuals. We had Dr. Joe Couture, who was a professor at Athabasca University. We had Elmer Ghostkeeper, who was involved in Métis politics. We had Gord Williams, who was also working for the federal government, all Indigenous people. And we had Zella Harris, Christine Daniels, and a few others that became board members. And so in January 21st of 1983, AMSA was incorporated as a society. And in the 1st of March, we were approved funding by the Secretary of State. And on March the 11th, they gave us the go-ahead to for funding. And so we published our first newspaper in the boardroom of Secretary of State, which was down on Jasper and about 111th Street across from the General Hospital. And we put out our first newspaper. I remember going out to Fort Saskatchewan, the press that was out there, and watching the first issues of AMSA, it was called AMSA at that time, come off the press. And it was a very, very proud moment. We had most of the staff from ANCS that had stuck around, and when we incorporated, they were all hired. And And that was the start. Our very first office was the boardroom of Secretary of State. We were there until March 31st, and on April 1st, we got a building above the President's Restaurant on 107th Avenue and 101st Street, between 101st and 102nd Street. And that's where we got our start. We started publishing Windspeaker for, or I should say AMSA, for the first 3 years, and then we ran a Name the Newspaper contest, and Terry Lusty submitted the winning name, which was Windspeaker, and we became Windspeaker 3 years later in 1986. So that's how Windspeaker got started. We had a great crew of very dedicated people at the start. They all knew what they were doing. And so, yeah, those were the fun years. A lot of lean times, and but you know, it is a very proud moment to, like I said, to watch the first editions of Windspeaker AMSA roll off the presses in 1983.
So, going from Windspeaker, the cyber publications that you started publishing, Windspeaker, Alberta Sweetgrass, and so on, the transition to radio. Tell us about the birth of CFWE.
In 1984, there was a program under the federal government called the Northern Native Access Program, and NNBAP, Northern Native Broadcast Access Program. And let me go back a little bit. It wasn't only the federal government that gave us funding in the beginning. The provincial government also gave us funding as well when we first started. So we were funded by both the provincial and the federal government. The Native Communications Program out of Ottawa, and it was just, like I said, a program of some sort under the provincial government. But our start in radio, the Northern Native Broadcast Access Program, NNBAP, had this program for radio. So we were, most societies did both radio and television. And I'm a strong believer in when you're going to do something, you want to do it right. And I'd rather build one strong infrastructure in radio than to build two weaker ones to try to do both radio and television. So we decided to focus on radio at first. And our very first program, I think it was a half hour or an hour weekly on CKUA. And later we came up with partnership with CBC Television, and we began broadcasting 8 o'clock in the morning to 9 o'clock on CBC Television. And so we were known as the radio on TV, and they had that, you know, the old signage when they were off the air, you know, with the Indian head. Mm-hmm. And so that was on the background, and our radio was in, you know, the audio part of it. So we did that for a few years. No, actually it wasn't a few years, it was a couple of years. And during that time, there was a distribution program out of Ottawa to help develop a network of small community radio stations throughout the north. So that very first year, we decided to add 10 small 10-watt community radio stations along the northeast side that CBC didn't cover. And so that would be Cold Lake, Elizabeth, Frog Lake, Cadott Lake, Lac La Biche, and places like that. So that was our first venture into radio. We were still on CBC TV. And then the second year, we added 12 more communities to this network. And at that time, CBDC decided that they wanted to cut the radio off of their distribution network. I kind of laughed at the time because they felt that cartoons in the morning were more important than Indigenous radio. So we got we ended our partnership with CBC, and by then we had 36 small isolated communities in northern Alberta. We added another 12 the following year, and then we had another 12 the year after. So we built up a network covering most of the isolated and communities in northern Alberta. And so we moved our radio station from Edmonton. We were in our own building producing, and we bought the old police RCMP barracks in Lac La Biche, the building. So our very first studios were in jail cells. And we used to joke with some of our on-air people because they said, yeah, I spent a lot of time here but in the past, and, but I wasn't on air. I was in jail. And so it was a fun time. We had some great people. And one of our longtime employees, Wally Desjardins, came as a intern out of high school, and he got his start with us. And, you know, one of the great guys that, you know, was on our air, on our programming for many, many years. And so we were in Lac La Biche for a few years. And meanwhile, AMHSA, we were in that building on 107th Avenue for 3 years. And in 1986, we purchased a building at 150th Street and 112th Avenue in the West End. And we were there for 17 years. Mm. And we were given permission. See, when with Northern Native Broadcast Access Program, we had to be north of the Hamlin Line, which is about 100 kilometers north of Edmonton. It went down Highway 16, and then there was like a little bump that went above Edmonton and continued west and on Highway 16. So we had to move to Lac La Biche because we had to be north of the Hamlin Line. Well, over the course of time, we were allowed to move our broadcast studios in Lac La Biche back to Edmonton. And we had purchased this building in the west end of Edmonton and built a studio in one of the warehouses that were in that building. And that's how CFWE came back to Edmonton. About that time, NCI in Manitoba and Mississippi Broadcasting in Saskatchewan were running Radio Bingo. Every time we'd have a national meeting, you know, they would say that they were making $300,000 a year on bingo, and you know, I always thought, wow, that would be a great opportunity for us. So I went out to NCI and I watched how they did it. I went out to Mississippi Broadcasting and saw how they did it. They ran one game formats for, you know, half hour, 20 minutes, and that was their bingo. I'd worked a lot of bingo in Edmonton as a softball coach and basketball coach, so I thought that in the north of northern Alberta, it would be more of a bingo hall experience. So that's why we went with 20-some games. There was seven games that we played on, or seven sheets that we played, about four games on each sheet, and we gave away a large jackpot of $5,000, and we ran it a couple times a year, a month, I'm sorry, we ran that a couple times a week, and that was our start in bingo. We did very well, and we started generating our revenue, and that revenue can't be used for anything else but distribution.
Right.
In 1985, we had a goal-setting workshop retreat out west of Edmonton here. And as an organization, we did some goal-setting, and I'm very goal-oriented. And one of the things that with goal-setting is you say anything, you write it down. Even though it's, you know, pie in the sky, never achieve it, all those sorts of things. And so some of the things that came out of that goal setting session was we want a 100,000 watt transmitter. We want to make $1 million in bingo. We want to do this. We want to do that. And so we put those aside as, yeah, right, you know, who knows, maybe someday. And then we worked on our more realistic goals. But you know what? Those goals stayed there. And eventually our bingo revenue grew to be over $1 million. Mm. And we used that revenue to put in one of our first 100,000 watt transmitters, which was Moose Hills up by in eastern Alberta. And with this 100,000 watt transmitter, it covered a huge area, and it allowed us to take out some of the smaller 10 watt transmitters that we had put in in that area. And then we reassigned those transmitters to other areas. We kind of started spreading our reach throughout Alberta. And then we put up another 10,000 watt transmitter in Slave Lake. When you used to drive along Slave Lake with the little 10 waters, you would listen to us in High Prairie and then lose us and pick us up in Sucker Creek and lose us and pick us up in Drift Pile and lose us and pick us up in Jusard and lose us. And pretty soon you got to Slave Lake and there we were again. And so when we put in this 10,000 watt transmitter in Jusard, that covered that whole area. And it allows us to take out those smaller transmitters again and extend our coverage elsewhere. Mm. So, and that's how our network began with CFWE.
Bert Kerfoot joining us. Of course, Bert is a great, great grandson of Chief Kerfoot, who signed Treaty 7. A few short years ago, you had the honor of sitting in with me when we started CJWE. And I remember sitting across from you and seeing the pride in your eyes when we started that broadcast in the AMSA studio that morning, hey?
Yeah. It's, well, you're like a proud father, right? And we, as we spread CJWE, you know, adding 100,000 watt transmitters, and we finally had an opportunity with the demise of the Aboriginal Voices radio network, the opportunity came up for two licenses, one in Calgary, the other in Edmonton. And so we went to the CRTC hearings. We applied for those two licenses, and we were successful in getting them. And so we used the money from bingo to launch CJWE in Calgary. It was a 100,000 watt transmitter. And so when we fired up that morning, I remember we have an awesome engineer by the name of Owen Martin, who is more like family than a consultant. He's an awesome guy. Mm-hmm. Very, very knowledgeable, very smart when it comes to building networks and that. So we we're on the CBC tower in Calgary. There's 27 other radio stations on that tower in Calgary. And I remember going down there that morning that they were ready to flip the switch. And I flipped the switch to launch CJWE. And, you know, just to hear it go out, listen to it in my vehicle. And then I went for a drive. I drove all the way out to Siksika, and I was going to keep on driving to Medicine Hat, but I figured, our main concern is to cover Siksika and the other First Nations in the Calgary area. So I went as far east as the Bizano, and our signal was still really, really strong. I came back on the back roads. I went into the river valleys and checked out how strong the signal was, and it was very powerful. And even in the river valleys, I came up the hill, and there was one spot just down from down by the bridge and towards Arrowwood, and There was a hill as I went between a gully, I guess, going up the hill up onto the top part that had died for like 2 seconds. So that was pretty good. I was pretty proud of that. And then I drove down to southern Alberta, and it went almost to Fort McLeod. I went out to Morley and drove around Morley, and I could pick it up. And I did a lot of driving that day. And then I headed home, and I picked it up almost to Red Deer. And so a very proud moment. We didn't have any studios down there. We went, once we were launched, we broadcast out of one of our production studios in Edmonton at our AMSA building. And we did that for a while until we finally got studio space on 101st Street in Calgary and built our studios down there. And, CJWE has been coming along. You know, I'm really pleased with the progress. We want to, you know, keep building that station to the point where, you know, it's like CFWE. I mean, CFWE is our flagship. The other station that we got out of that Aboriginal Voices network was Edmonton. So what do we do with the one in Edmonton? We've already got CFWE. And so we decided we were going to call it the Raven, CIWE. And when I had made the presentation to the CRTC commissioners in Ottawa, and we talked about format, and I said, well, it's going to be anything but country. And so that's kind of where it went from there. So we focused on older country with CFWE, CJW, and we also focused on everything else but country. We had a lot of Indigenous artists, and as well as unknown artists, guys just starting out, and a lot of older country when it came to CJ and CF, and so I was quite proud of that. But then an opportunity that we see what we've, my line of thinking is, I'm always trying to see what's going to be happening in 5 years. Mm. And so it's kind of like two lines that intersect as it goes. They go apart, then they'll cross. And then I try to figure out what's going to be happening in 4 or 5 years and plan and start developing things so that the next time that the next stage of technology, that we're ready for it. And so we decided to launch Cousin Radio. I was talking with different people, and they were talking about the, you know, terrestrial radio will only be around for another 70 years, and the next phase is going to be, instead of towers, they're going to be using satellites. So I wanted to develop a radio station that would be able to bounce from satellite to satellite, and that's why we've been working on Cousin Radio. But we wanted Cousin Radio to be special. So we decided it was going to be 100% Indigenous, all genres. And I'm really proud of what you and your team have done to make Cousin Radio an awesome radio station. It doesn't have as many listeners as the rest, but I think down the road it's going to be a major player in the future of what we're doing.
Bert, you know, we were talking about the four stations we have. Let's talk a bit about the people behind the mic. I mean, they don't get the accolades they deserve half the time. And I'm not talking about present, but I'm talking about the start of CFWE to CJWE to the Raven. We've had some pretty great people behind the scenes, eh?
Yeah, we have. We started off with Jeff Baer. He was the guy that worked on the NNBAP to develop the proposal. You know, we were approved for funding. Once we got funding, we started working on programming. And he was with us for about 3 years. And after that, we had a couple of other people that have been here. Al Sanderwick, who was our technician, and he looked after our radio station for about 8 or 9 years. And then after that, we've had different people come in. One thing I've always found about radio is Indigenous radio is that we've always wanted to be professional. Mm. And a lot of times we brought in non-Indigenous people to help us get to that level. But the one thing that non-Indigenous people, the one setback or drawback from having non-Indigenous people run your programming is they don't understand Indigenous people.
Right.
And by not understanding Indigenous people, you miss the boat when it comes to reaching that audience. And so when COVID happened, we cut back on staff, and we have all Indigenous on-air crew. And we, as Indigenous people, are storytellers. And when we look at mainstream broadcasting, you got 30 seconds, you don't have 32 seconds, you don't have 28 seconds, you got 30 seconds, and everything is straight to the second. Yep. And so you do all of your breaks and everything else along those very strict confines. When we started doing language programming, we would have a 30-second English spot, but Indigenous language is very descriptive, and a lot of times you can't do that same 30-second spot in English, in Indigenous language. So you would have a 30-second spot, and maybe, if you're lucky, something that's under a minute, under 60 seconds.
Right.
And so we made the decision about a few years ago that, okay, we're storytellers. We're going to relax those mainstream guidelines, and we're going to develop our own Indigenous format, mm-hmm. or style of broadcasting. We did the same thing in newspaper. Years ago, there was the AP style book that all of the editors followed. Mm. And it's how you say certain things, which names are capitalized. So as a writer, as a newspaper person, you followed that style book. Well, after a while, you know, being Indigenous, we started developing our own style book. You know, it's called a teepee style book. And so every Indigenous First Nation, and every time we said Indian or Indigenous, it was capitalized. So we developed our own style book. Hmm. And then we did the same thing with radio. We started developing our own Indigenous style of broadcasting. We're storytellers.
Yeah.
And I kind of chuckle when I see a lot of our Indigenous people who have worked in mainstream media, and they're so used to that 30-second spot that they want to cut, and now that they've been told no, you know, you're a storyteller, tell your story. If it takes a minute, then take a minute. So, and I really enjoy that. I feel proud of it because, you know, I've been in the media for 45 years. I've been at ANC, AMSA for 40 years. You know, next week is going to be our 40th anniversary since we published our first issue of AMSA, our Windspeaker. And so, you know, watching how everything has developed over those 40 years, you know, from emulating mainstream media to become more professional, and going from there to becoming more Indigenous,
right,
and develop our own style of broadcasting, and I'm very proud to say that, you know, we're one of the leaders in Indigenous when it comes to Indigenous broadcasting. Yep. Of what we're doing. You know, we were the first to start doing bilingual broadcasting with English and then Indigenous language, and we have 7 Indigenous languages that we're working with. We have Blackfoot, Cree, Dene. We got three Dene languages. We got Sutina, Northern Dene, and Eastern Cold Lake area Dene. We've got
Nakota.
We have Machif and, you know, Sandra Crowfoot, who is our language person, has worked really hard at trying to get all of those languages on the air. And, you know, it may sound a lot easier because everybody says, I know a lot of people who will do it. But, you know, getting someone to do it has actually been a really tough job. But we've managed to find some great interpreters.
Yeah.
And like I said, we're, you know, as goal setter, as a person that believes in goal setting, you know, we've set goals, we've achieved those goals, we've more than achieved a lot of goals. I mean, right now, one of my goals is to be able to say 1 million, you know, watts of indigenous power, you know, and right now we're just under 900,000.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we've got Lethbridge coming on stream in this summer. We have Medicine Hat coming on next year. We're working on High Level, bringing them on stream next year. And right now, that's just CF and CJW.
Yeah.
We're also looking at expanding the Raven to all of our 100,000-watt transmitters, our 10,000-watt transmitters in Slave Lake, down at Porcupine Hills in southern Alberta. Lac La Biche is 20,000 watts. We're going to kick that up to 100,000 watts. And all of this from bingo money. Like, you know, we get a lot of people complaining about, you got to give away more money. But, you know, unfortunately, our hands are tied by Alberta Gaming with how much we can give away. But all of the money that we use from bingo goes into our distribution. It goes into expanding and developing our networks. And right now, like I said, we've got around 900,000 watts of indigenous broadcasting power. You know, we cover the whole province, top to bottom.
Yeah. You've been doing this for 40 plus years, but you still have that thrill. You still have that passion, eh?
Yeah, it's, well, I still have the passion, but, you know, the energy and the legs aren't there. So that's why you guys are here, right? You know, you guys and all of the staff that we have are, you know, we have awesome staff.
Yeah.
You know, I'm really proud of all of them and what they've done. And, you know, it's like a big family. Everybody's working together. Everybody's got energy. There's not one ego bigger than another's. And people helping each other out. It's great to see that. Mm-hmm. You know, people are, you know, like, if I help you along, then it's going to make us better.
Right.
You know, it's that mentality. And that's, like I said, one thing I'm really proud of, because a lot of times this radio game can be really competitive and people step on other people to get up.
Yep.
And that doesn't happen here.
Yep.
And so I'm, like I said, I'm proud of that. I'm proud of the work that you have done. You've done a great job. And your staff have done a great job. And, yeah, it's a good feeling when you come in and you watch staff. And I watch a lot of people. You know, sometimes I don't talk as much as I normally do. But, you know, I like to watch. I like to listen because I can learn a lot about people from that.
You're a great coach, though. I mean, you know, coaching softball, you coached your daughter's team many years ago, but you also coach behind the scenes. I mean, a lot of people know that you and I talk umpteen times a day about, you know, your vision of AMSA, the Windspeaker Radio Network, and really where you want to take this company. But I want to talk about something here for a second. I want to talk about the honors you've had over your lifetime. And you're like, Jeremy, come on, don't put me on the spot. But we're going to do this. Lifetime Achievement Award from the province of Alberta. Venture Magazine's 50 Most Influential Individuals in Alberta. 100 Entrepreneurs Who Built Alberta. Nominated to Alberta 100 list and inducted into the Aboriginal Walk of Honor in Edmonton. Of course, I just mentioned coaching Team Alberta Women's Softball at the 1993 Canada Summer Games. After all that, give us a sense of something that over your 40 plus years, not only in AMSA, but your personal life, something that really means a lot to you or really stands out for you?
Personal? It's always family.
Yeah. Yeah. And your family means a lot to you.
Yep. You know, we have our first granddaughter, beautiful young lady, Anna Shea.
Mm-hmm.
Watching her grow, it's great, you know. I mean, when I coached over the years, I've had some great mentors. One of them was Ralph Weekly. He was the head coach of Pacific Lutheran University in Tacoma, Washington. He was NAIA Coach of the Year. His team was national champions. He was the U.S. Olympic coach in the 1996 Olympics in Atlanta, Georgia. And I met him at one of the workshops when I was first started coaching. I wanted to improve myself, and I decided that I had to learn from the best. And so I went to a workshop in Tacoma, Washington, and they brought all these American coaches in. And so I learned from these guys. And then when I came back, when I was first started coaching, I brought these American coaches up here, a different coach every year, and they worked with my kids, and they worked with my kids for free. I mean, I paid them. I paid their travel up here. I paid them an honorarium, but I didn't charge my kids a cent. And what I did was I opened up the other 50% of the time to other players, to other teams, so that they could benefit from this coach's knowledge. You know, I'm a strong believer that, you know, I don't want to build up my team so it kicks, so they kick everybody's behind.
Right.
Because that'll only make my team so strong. And in order to build them up into a stronger team, you need stronger opponents. It's like lifting weights. The more weights you lift, the stronger you get. So I strongly believed in developing my opponents. So if they got stronger, they gave me a harder time, it made us better. And so by doing that and learning from these coaches, Ralph Weekly gave me his team handbook. And that's something that I've developed and I've added to it over the years. And in it is a lot of other things. The other thing is my brother Strader gave me a set of tapes back in the 80s, 90s, cassette tapes. And it was Psychology of Winning by Dr. Dennis Waitley. And so I put one of those cassette tapes in for a week in my truck as I drove around and listened to it. Week two, I flipped it over and listened to side two. And after doing that for 12 weeks and listening for 12 weeks, what he was saying about the psychology of winning, the 10 qualities of a winner, changed my life. How I approach things, building your opponents to make you stronger. You know, whenever something bad happens, what's the lesson? What's the positive? And things like that. Goal setting's a huge part of that.
Yep.
So by applying, I had a young lady that I used to coach in basketball, and a lot of the stuff that I learned, I passed on to my athletes in coaching. And she told me she was an EMS instructor now. She was taking managerial courses through EMS. And, you know, she wrote me a letter on her wedding. I took her wedding pictures, and she sent me a thank you card. And she says, I'm taking managerial courses, and, I'm sitting here thinking, I've heard this all before, you know. I was 12 when you taught me all of this. So, proud moment. When you see your kids succeed, you know, your players succeed, then another proud moment. Mm. You know, when you watch your employees and on-air people succeed, another proud moment.
Mm.
You know, a lot of times you don't get paid money, but you get paid in watching others succeed,
mm-hmm.
which is a far better payday than money. So I'll need to borrow $20 for lunch.
You know, we got to wrap things up here, but, you know, as you mentioned, AMSA celebrating our 40th anniversary. And I mean, this is going to be a hard question, but if you can sum up the 40 years in a couple of words, how would you do it?
Awesome.
Mm-hmm.
It was exciting building. And then there was a time where it was building, but it was becoming stale.
Mm-hmm.
And one of my philosophies, surround yourself with strong, good people and get out of their way. And so I got out of their way, but it didn't go anywhere. And the last 3 years over COVID had a lot of positive things.
Yep.
I mean, it had mm-hmm. a lot of negative things too, but you know that saying when it says when something bad happens, what's the positive, right? Well, there's a lot of positives that came out of COVID.
Yep.
You know, watching this organization grow, being hands-on again and helping to grow the members of this team and watching them grow. And it's exciting again.
Yep.
It's fun. I'm not hands-on as I used to be, but I'm teaching other people to do the things that I used to do. And that's the satisfying thing.
Yep.
It's, you know, I've reached the mushroom, the grandfather stage of my life with a granddaughter. I've reached the mushroom side of my life when we launched Cousin. I was no longer the father. I was the grandfather, and you were the father. And so it's just the circle of life.
Yep.
And so, you know, it's very satisfying watching this organization grow and develop. And I mean, we've had some awesome people. I mean, Carol Russ has been with us for 40 years, you know, almost a day one employee. And she's really strict with finances. I gave her an Indian name years ago. I called her Three Horses. And she goes, "Wow, why'd you call me Three Horses?" I go, "Nag, nag, nag." But, you know, she's family. You know, she's the reason that for the financial side that we've done well.
Yeah.
I'm more on the vision side. And the rest of you guys are on the let's get her done, yeah. let's work and get this place going.
Yeah, exactly.
So, I mean, all parts of the engine working together.
Bert Crowfoot, CEO, founder of the Aboriginal Multimedia Society of Alberta. Happy 40th, Bert. It's been a ride and many, many years to go.
I hope so. I'm aiming for 50.